National news from a grassroots perspective. You're listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast.
It was only when I actually passed out and collapsed is when they took notice.
This has had a direct impact of lowering quality and lowering accessibility to these social programs.
Child welfare has been used as a blunt instrument in First Nations families, disrespecting history, disrespecting culture, and disrespecting the rights of kids.
When we hold our pride in our integrity, our bravery guides us.
Hello and welcome to Groundwire. This is Bob the Postman.
And I'm Catherine Fisher.
Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
This episode of Groundwire is brought to you from Senex Ancestral Territory. In our first feature, Gunarji O'Sullivan of Vancouver Co-op Radio speaks with Mary Ellen Turpo-Lafond, the independent representative for children and youth in BC, and also with Sequepmek author Gary Gottfriedson about Aboriginal kids and Aboriginal child welfare services in BC.
We'll also hear from Amelie Phillipson reporting from CKUT about the assay demonstration against government austerity programs, which happened April 3rd in Montreal.
NCJSF's Frieda Worden reports on the loss of the Canada Health Accord and a grassroots national movement calling for a new accord.
But first, the headlines.
Here's Sula Sidnell Green reporting for Groundwire.
At the March 31st Maritimes Energy Association briefing, the Nova Scotian Energy Minister planned to discuss new oil and gas projects moving forward. This included the Energy East pipeline. The briefing was shut down by several Mi'kmaq women, whose protests were supported by environmental organizers, including Power Shift Atlantic, a climate justice conference that brought hundreds of youth to Halifax that weekend. Eliza Knockwood and her 14-year-old daughter took the stage to protest harmful extraction on unceded land. She shared her message with many in the room that water and land are sacred, eventually bringing the briefing to a close. The reverberations of her actions were felt by those who recognized the urgency of protecting the environment and supporting Indigenous struggles.
Eliza Knockwood. Hello, everyone. My name is Starchild Eliza Knockwood, and I am from Abiquiu, Prince Edward Island.
Can you tell us a little bit about the rally on March 31st?
It was intimidating. There was resistance on the floor, and there was some booing that happened from supposedly professional people, adults. But I continued to go forward, to move forward with pride and integrity, because it's really important that we do that today. When we hold our pride and our integrity, our bravery guides us. And it took great bravery that day, and I'm so very proud of my daughter, who stood and never closed her eyes once and took a really good long look at the people in the room and their behaviors, whether it be good or disrespectful. That's what's really important in my role, is looking at my daughter's future, my future grandchildren that haven't arrived yet, and wanting a better, healthier earth and community and territory for that generation coming.
Yasmin from Prison Radio brings us this headline.
Christine Hemingway had spent time incarcerated in the BC Corrections and had spent time in several different places with BC Corrections, the Surrey Pretrial Service Center and the Alouette Correctional Center for Women from July 2005 to November 2006. And Christine filed a lawsuit against BC Corrections on many different counts, in large part due to the neglect or the lack of health care that she received and longstanding medical problems that she now faces.
What happened was I kept putting in requests to see the doctor because I was getting sick, and I could feel it was getting worse. So then what happened was my urine infection turned into, my bladder infection turned into a kidney infection. I had a doctor that was trying to help me because there was two different doctors that would come. And she actually wrote me a prescription, and the nurse took it out of her hand and tore it up.
In Canada, which is a country known for, you know, social health care that's not privatized, we have this phenomenon of privatization within provincial prison health care.
I don't think that in the women's prison or the men's prisons that it should be privatized and contracted out. And the simple reason is because it's about the bottom dollar. It was only when I actually passed out and collapsed is when they took notice.
Right.
And that seemed to happen all the time there. As if you're dropping, literally dropping, is when you get their attention. And then I was rushed into the hospital. I ended up having multiple blood clots in both my lungs, upper and lower, and blood clots in my left leg.
Because BC Corrections did settle with you, do you feel like in part that they're acknowledging part of its wrongdoing and how they handled your health care?
Oh, absolutely. They knew that they treated me wrong. They knew that I had a very strong case. They didn't want it to go to trial.
Founded in 1892 in California, Sierra Club is one of the oldest environmental organizations in North America. Floris Ensick is the president of Sierra Club Quebec.
It's really an environmental organization, but a grassroots environmental organization with different chapters across the country working on really local environmental issues. And the philosophy is that we want to engage people to protect their own environment. So it's really local, citizen, grassroots environmental activism.
Sierra Club Quebec has a program on the protection of green spaces in and around Montreal.
Protection of green spaces requires serious attention here in Montreal. There's very little left, and whatever is left is still under a lot of threat from construction and pollution and all kinds of developments.
Floris Ensink explained that there is a tendency to underestimate the importance of green spaces because it doesn't bring in any direct income. However, green spaces are very important in a city for health reasons.
There's a book that has been written by Dr. François Reeves recently who shows all kinds of relationships between health problems, health issues, and the presence of trees and nature in the environment in which we live.
Floris Ensink explained that whilst looking at municipal finances, if you get rid of green spaces, you could end up with more health problems. So being more concerned about green spaces could be a way to prevent higher expenditures in healthcare.
There should be much more of a long-term and holistic view about these issues, not only looking at your particular budget and see how it can make a tree generate your any income, but that's because that's not the way it works. That's not going to happen. So it is really about having a broader view on nature.
Thanks to CKUT in Montreal and to Amélie Philipson, Sula Sidnell Green, and Yasmin from Prison Radio for headlines.
Welcome back to Groundwire, a biweekly, nonprofit national news program produced by the community for the community. Groundwire is heard on dozens of community radio stations across Canada. And now for our feature stories.
The independent representative for children and youth in BC, Mary Ellen Turpel-Lafond, outlined the findings of her office's recent review of Aboriginal Child Welfare Services in BC in a report titled, When Talk Trumped Service. A decade of lost opportunity for Aboriginal children and youth in BC. Vancouver Co-op Radio's Gennarji O'Sullivan spoke with Turpel-Lafond, as well as with Tsleil-Waututh poet and author Gary Gottfriedson, about the report and about the importance of providing ongoing access to language and cultural resources for Aboriginal families.
We have the representative for children and youth, Mary Ellen Turpel Lafond, and she is responsible for a number of reports that have been submitted from 2007 to 2014. She has been referred to as the MCFD watchdog, and she's here with us today to tell us more about the reports that have been released from 2007 to 2014. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here. And I'll also say that my First Nations name, my Indian name, is Akikwe. And I'm a member of the Muskeg Lake Cree Nation in Saskatchewan. But I am the independent child advocate for BC. And I have been pretty busy since 2007 looking at cases involving First Nations and Métis children throughout British Columbia. I've had more than 12,000 advocacy cases and had to produce quite a few reports about whether or not we're making the difference we need to make in the lives of families to support children, First Nations children, to stay strongly connected to their culture, their language, and their families.
Mainstream media is covering this report. It seems like it reflects badly on First Nations child and family, but while talking to you now, it's very clear that it's a reflection of government policies and services.
I think that's a really big issue, that how things get interpreted when they come out. You know, I really look at it from the perspective of how are children being served. And for First Nations children, you know, they have rights. They have the right to be safe. They have the rights under, you know, the UN Convention, the Rights of the Child, the child welfare legislation. But they also have the right to be connected to their family, to their community, their language. You have to be connected to your family, usually to be connected to your language and your culture, depending on what your nation tribe is. And in BC, you know, of the kids in care, the 8,000 or more kids in care, more than half are Aboriginal. Most of them are First Nations from First Nations communities in BC, although they do come from First Nations communities all over Canada. And what I find is that there have been a lot of talk. My report was called When Talk Trumps Service. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of talk at, you know, hotel rooms in Richmond and Vancouver about what to do about these issues. But have we really got down with the kids to really engage with what they need? And I know, you know, Woody and his work with VACFAS is working with families and dads and kids. And we need more of that on the ground. Mm-hmm. And a lot of money has been spent on the talking. But the talking doesn't go to change. And so my point in that report was to say we've had a decade. $66 million was spent in BC over a decade in these hotel rooms talking about, are we going to have a different system of governance? But we don't have any services. You know, when we look at the lives of children, particularly children in crisis, they may have been abused or neglected. Their parents are coming to grips with residential school history, being wrenched out of their communities. Their families are coming to grips with poverty in this province, not having treaties, not having a land base, yet seeing this incredible prosperity around them. Just the disempowerment. Their families are really struggling with that. Now, the families are hugely resilient, but you can't just treat that like a budget item. First Nations children, they have a right to be raised in their family, mm-hmm. and they have a right to be raised inside their culture and community. And so I don't want children to be removed, and families don't want that. But that's a different model. The government needs to learn that and respect that. Child welfare has been used as a blunt instrument in First Nations families, disrespecting history, disrespecting culture, and disrespecting the rights of kids.
Sequitmic poet and author Larry Gottfredson, who also works with Indigenous children, echoed Mary Ellen Turpel Lafond's recommendations.
Anybody can find, anybody would know that culture and identity are critical to a child's upbringing. And if we're looking at it from you know, a policy level, I mean, that there should be very strong policies to support Aboriginal children. It doesn't matter which nation, Aboriginal nation they come from, but to provide resources and sources for them so that they can keep that connection to their language and culture and their nation.
What do you mean by resources and sources?
Well, teachers, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, these children should have access to let's say if they're a Cree child in a foster home, I believe that there should be policy for that child to be able to have access to a Cree-speaking person, you know, within the town or district or whatever, wherever they come from, right? Wherever they're living. And the resources available in terms of human resources, knowledge keepers, language speakers, materials written by Aboriginal people. And we know that there's a lot of material written by Aboriginal people across this country. There's a strong movement within the arts and literature for Aboriginal people here in Canada.
On April 3rd, several thousand protesters gathered in Montreal to demonstrate against government austerity programs. Here's Amelie Philipson from CKUT in Montreal with the details.
On April 3rd, over 50,000 students were on strike to protest against the Parti Québécois austerity plan. At 2 p.m., several thousand protesters, including many students, were gathered outside the Berry-UQAM metro station on the Place Émilie-Gamelin. This demonstration was organized by ASSE, the Association pour une solidarité syndicale étudiante. The police were surrounding the square and declared the demonstration illegal on the grounds of the Montreal Municipal Bylaw P6 before the crowd took the streets. No itinerary was given. This demonstration was supported by numerous social groups, communities, and feminist organizations, including Greenpeace, social rights group Frappru, the Federation of Women of Quebec, and the coalition opposed to the tarification and the privatization of public services. Benjamin Gingras, a representative of ASSE, spoke out to the press a few minutes before the march started.
Today, we're over 60,000 students on strike alongside workers' unions, women's groups, environmental groups, community groups, in order to participate to ASSE's national demonstration against austerity and for a fair share of the tax burden. We've seen in recent years recent governments accumulating austerity measures, cutting in social services, charging for them. This has had a direct impact of lowering quality and lowering accessibility to these social programs. Let's face it, austerity creates social inequality and exacerbates existing ones. ASSE's demands are very simple. Through simple measures, through simple fiscal alternatives, more than $10 billion can be generated for the state's coffers to show that austerity is not necessary. For instance, a return of the capital tax, a return to 10 tax brackets, which alone would generate about $1.2 billion. ASSE's demands are very clear. Austerity will not be tolerated. The thousands of students who are here, thousands of other people who are here, we will not allow another austerity budget. We show austerity is dangerous, it is unnecessary, and it will be fought. Whoever is elected on April 7th, we will be there, all of us, and we will show them that austerity will not be tolerated in Quebec. The history of the student movement is a continuation of social struggles. We will, of course, continue to build pressure, and if it involves more demonstrations, more strikes, well, that's up to them.
Le capitaine nous fait la gare! Gare au capitaine! Le capitaine nous fait la gare! Gare au capitaine!
Once the crowd was gathered and had invaded the streets around Place Émilie-Gamelin, opening speeches were given, insisting on the fact that austerity is only a political choice, an ideology, and that Quebec has other choices, other options that will prioritize helping the population in need of social attention.
Camarades, aujourd'hui nous avons raison de faire ce qu'on fait. Nous avons raison d'informer les gens. Nous avons raison de mobiliser. Nous avons raison de manifester et de bloquer. Et il faut continuer. Il ne faudrait pas, certainement pas lâcher, surtout aujourd'hui, alors qu'on cumule les mesures d'austérité et qu'on appauvrit et la classe moyenne et qu'on enfonce les gens les plus précaires dans une plus grande précarité. Nous avons la responsabilité de faire avancer les conditions sociales au Québec et de créer le changement social. Nous sommes les mêmes magiciennes qui élèveront le bien commun au Québec. Ce n'est qu'un début. Continuons le combat. Faisons monter la pression.
Ah!
At the demonstration, opening speeches included one about how austerity is touching culture and how culture is being used by the current Parti Québécois government. Speeches attacked not only the Quebec PQ government, but also the federal Harper government. This is Emily Philipson reporting for Groundwire.
Frida Worden from CJSF in Burnaby, BC, reports on the loss of the current Canada Health Accord, which expired on March 31st of this year, and a national movement calling for a new accord.
Rallies were held in about 40 communities across Canada on March 31st, the day the Canada Health Accord expired after 10 years in effect. Among the protesters was Rich Hagenson, an organizer with the BC Health Coalition and the Council of Canadians.
There was rallies across Canada. We had one in Campbell River here outside Conservative MP John Duncan's office. There was over 50 people there, and there was a lot of good energy, information given out. There was some speeches, and there were postcards signed. And this just the beginning of a campaign over the next few months is going to roll out for the health for a new health care accord and to put pressure on the leaders in this country to take some leadership. And in Harper's case, get back to the table and renegotiate a health accord. And the opposition parties' cases to, again, show some leadership and bring this matter up in the House of Commons and press the and the premiers to get back to the table to press the government to do that.
Hagenson gave the history of the Canada Health Accord.
You know, when Medicare came in the 60s, there was basically up to into the 80s or so a 50-50 sharing of health care costs, you know, between the federal government and the provinces who administer the health care. And then it started to, throughout the 80s and into the 90s, started to go down to the point where it was down to about 10% funding by the federal government. So, you know, the premiers of the provinces were getting quite distraught about that and pressed Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin to negotiate the accord, which was done in 2004, and it was a 10-year accord and expired on Monday, on March 31st.
So what were the new things that were introduced by the accord then, or the important ones?
It guaranteed pretty stable health care funding, you know, throughout the provinces and territories. It ensured equality of access to health care across provinces and territories so that no matter where you went in Canada, you got more or less the same standard of health care services. It had national standards and accountability for health care funds that were transferred, you know, from the federal government to the provinces so that money that was transferred had to actually be spent on health care. It couldn't just go into general revenue. So those are the main facets of it, and it's resulted in the federal government providing, it's actually 20.4% at the present time of the province's health care budget.
In 2012, the premiers asked Harper to sit down and negotiate a new health accord, but he refused. He has unilaterally fixed health transfer payment increases at 6% a year, set to drop to 3% in 2017, unless there's a windfall in Canada's GDP. His 2014 budget also eliminates equalization payments, intended to maintain the same level of care across provinces, and now links health transfers to population numbers rather than need. Alberta is expected to be a comparative winner in transfer payments this year, and BC a big loser. Apart from money, activists for a new health accord decry the loss of federal leadership and leverage to get things done. Rick Turner, co-chair of the BC Health Coalition.
We've joined together with a lot of other groups, the Canadian Doctors for Medicare. Here in BC, the retired teachers are another group, the Council of Canadians right across Canada, as well as the Canadian Health Coalition. All of us are working together to let the federal government know that we're not happy with this, and we would like to see them get back to the table, provide some leadership, get together with the other provinces, and work out a health accord that suits all Canadians, no matter which province they live in, and ensures that all Canadians receive good level care. And we're also inviting them to bring in some of the innovations that are available to us now, too, such as the National Pharmacare Plan. If the drugs were bought at a national level, generic drugs were bought at a national level, then we could save the healthcare system $10 billion. That's what some estimates range up.
Rich Haganson and his partner Joanne Banks wrote a song calling for a new national health accord, which they perform at the rallies in Campbell River, B.C.
Medicare has got us covered. Get on board the new health care accord. Medicare has got us covered. Get on board the new health care accord.
Reporting for Groundwire from CJSF-FM, I'm Frieda Worden.
That's all for this edition of Groundwire. Make sure to tune in to our next episode produced by CKUT-FM in Montreal, Quebec.
Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. All of our episodes are available for listening and podcasting at groundwire.ncra.ca. Be sure to check out the NCRA National Conference coming up in June in Victoria, BC. The conference will be a week of workshops, meetings, keynotes, panels, industry networking, and fun activities. You can find out more at cfuvncrc2014.com.
If you're interested in contributing as a journalist, get in touch with us by email at groundwireprod, that's groundwire, P-R-O-D, at gmail.com.
This edition of Groundwire was hosted and produced by volunteers at CJLY-FM in Nelson, B.C., on Sinaixt Ancestral Territory. Music in this episode was by Buffy St. Marie and Miriam Perron. We thank contributors Gennarji O'Sullivan, Emily Philipson, Frieda Worden, Sula Sidnell Green, Catherine Fisher, Yasmin from Prison Radio, and especially Carly Forbes.
From all of us at Groundwire, thanks for tuning in.